This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I knew I should have worn more paisley. You can work yourself into anything. You can work yourself into anything. How do you get out of it? You can work yourself into anything. How do you get out of it? You move on. I'll be dead 1,000 years, see, so if I don't do it right now. If I don't do it right now.
That's a slice from an ode to the beat poet Neil Cassady from the Australian band Pagan Love Cult. At the end of this show, you'll hear their full song, Everything I Know. Part of doing right is cutting out the big agri-food machine that is killing people, the soil, and the atmosphere. In this week's program, we'll consider a late winter remedy, growing food under lights. Our guest is Philip Beer. Sunglasses on, flick the switch. This is Radio That Grows. Welcome to an informal workshop on growing food indoors and just growing food generally. My guest in the studio is Philip Beer, owner of Home Harvest Farms in Vancouver, Canada. His company makes durable and portable container garden equipment. Philip also teaches sustainability and he's active in the local food movement. So we're going to go beyond growing indoors to talk about our general food supply and maybe learn why growing your own food makes so much sense these days. Philip, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
It's nice to be here, Alex.
You've brought in a piece of show-and-tell equipment, but before we talk about that, I'd like to hear a little bit about yourself and how you got into the whole food movement.
My background is engineering technology, and in my early 20s or my 30s, I lived on a kibbutz in Israel where I lived the life of a farmer, providing mostly technical support to the other farmers and logistical support to the kibbutz village that I was living on. And I've had high hopes for being able to make a difference to climate, to try and shift the trend towards worse symptoms of global warming, of climate change. Some of my work has involved renewable energy. Some of my work has involved community work. But I was feeling frustrated by the lack of progress that those things were bringing as I watched the climate situation getting worse from year to year. I was looking for something that every single person, every child can get involved in that will instantly begin to make a difference to what's going on. And the place where I think we can best do that is by putting our energy into growing food on a local basis when we do that without using chemicals.
Well, you've really caught my attention right away when you say you were providing technical support. I mean, I've been a part-time farmer, let's say, you know, the tractor, some acres, some chickens, some pigs and all that. I didn't have any technical support other than a fellow who helped me fix the tractor occasionally. So what kind of thing were you doing?
Working on the structures within the kibbutz, so taking care of all the systems and the buildings, taking care of the dairy that had about 200 milking cows. So providing logistical support, helping them to build cow sheds and working on tractors. And we took that a step further and started to develop agricultural machinery. And one of the most wonderful inventions that we were able to participate in developing was a system that pasteurizes fruit and vegetables and extends the shelf life of fruit and vegetables using nothing more than hot water.
That sounds amazing. So that technology's out there. How would we find that if we were looking for it?
And that's a question that I ask myself, and I don't believe that that technology managed to get out of Israel, even though the farmers who invested in the equipment saw massive returns very, very rapidly on their investments.
That may be an opportunity for someone in North America if they get on board with that. So you came to Canada, you're in Vancouver, and you've started your own business.
That's right. For many years, I've worked in building energy efficiency as one of the things that I did after arriving in Canada. And saw opportunities, felt frustration that we weren't able to really upgrade the stock that we were living in to much more energy efficient buildings mostly because there wasn't the will either at higher levels or of individuals. But one of the things that I learned there was that we're inhabiting buildings that seem to be warm enough for food, for growing food. And I asked myself the question, well, aren't we missing a fabulous opportunity? What happens if we were to bring food growing into these buildings? And so after asking that question, being the technical person that I am, I started to experiment and prototype, and one thing led to another until I designed a system that was durable and could be used indoors and outdoors for growing food in a compact space.
And there's a little less guilt doing that with lights, I think, in Vancouver, because we don't have any coal plants. We don't have any nuclear plants. It's coming out of hydroelectricity, which is relatively green as long as we don't flood too many more valleys. Well, you brought a system here today. Why don't we talk about that? Because it's not going to use very much energy. What have you got in the bucket here?
Sure. So what I brought for you today is a mini system that is constructed with a number of stainless steel troughs that we fill with soil. And I like to use soil because it creates the opportunity to build microorganism communities that will support growth as much as possible. And I've chosen stainless steel because it landed up after experimenting with different plastic materials and looking at a whole bunch of different choices. Even though stainless steel is a relatively exotic material, from a cost-effectiveness perspective, it's the most effective material that I can use. So these 24-inch planter troughs sit on a stepped platform, and above them we place a fluorescent T5 grow light, and we add plants, we add water, and whatever skills and talents we need in order to nurture the plants. And it enables us on our tabletop or on the floor of our living room to grow food in close proximity to the kitchen where we're going to be using it.
Right. I'd like to grab the fresh herbs that I want. I just used some oregano the other day, and I looked at it, and it was all very dead, very brown, very dry. I don't know how long it had been in this bottle. And I thought, well, I should be able to just pick it off the plant and use it, you know. And the same with basil and all sorts of things. So I'm buying this from you today, and I want to use it. I want to give it a try. I'm thinking of the various things I could grow in it. Now, one of the things I wanted to ask you, we're all concerned about plastics and whether plastics are leaching into our food at various points. And this is one of the things I like about your stainless steel setup. I don't have to worry about that. Did you look into that? Can plastics get into plant roots and eventually into our food, or do we know?
I'm concerned enough as somebody who's interested in eating food as pure as I can, let's say taking the precautionary principle and saying that it's possible that they can, so why do something that's going to create that option? By using stainless steel, I achieve two things. One of them is I avoid that possibility, and the other is that I've created something that when I'm looking at sustainability, it might be energy intensive to make the stainless steel. But the system that you're going to be buying from me today will probably be with your grandchildren if you have any.
Right. I've had a couple of other metal growing containers, and they just rusted out and they're gone. So I hope it will last a long time. I hope to use it for a long time. And then you've got something in the bottom to sort of collect the water, because I know from my own experience in growing that if the roots are sitting in too much wetness, the plant just dies. I mean, that people overwater their plants. That's what kills more houseplants than anything else.
Well, that's right. And so these guys allow the water to escape from the bottom of the planter. And underneath the soil, I place either a thin layer of coconut fiber or, in this case, a plastic inverted tube, or half a tube, and that keeps enough of the root space dry and allows the water to escape freely through the edge of the planter.
Mm-hmm. And now, can you tell us about this light bulb? I mean, some people are not familiar that there are fluorescents that can mimic the sunlight. That's what we're talking about, isn't it?
That's correct. So these are the most energy-efficient fluorescence lights that we're able to purchase. And the frequency and intensity has been tweaked. Thankfully, I can say in BC, thanks to the people who've had an interest in growing pot and have been willing to invest large amounts of money in the design of these lighting systems. But they have been optimized for plant growth. And with relatively small amounts of energy, we're able to get good growth from our plants.
Yeah, I was kind of concerned about that because I used fluorescence before myself. But I probably didn't have as good bulbs because I could only sort of get seedlings going, but I couldn't really get You couldn't grow something like a tomato plant under them, for example. Tomato plants just take a lot of light to really produce tomatoes. But I'm going to give these a try and see just how much you can get out of a modern fluorescent.
I've found them to be really impressive lights. And one of the things that I love about them is for a system that has, say, two or three lights, you're probably going to be spending $2 to $4 a month on your vegetables. And to make up that amount of money by not having to purchase it at the store is not too great a challenge.
Yeah, I can grab just a few vegetables at the store and it's already $4 one time. So if I can grow them cheaply, I will. And I'm looking forward to giving that a chance. And then you also make a much bigger unit, a 4-foot-long unit that would hold a lot more soil. I didn't get it because I'm in a condo right now and I just don't have room for it, but I'd love to have it. So do you want to talk to us about what that is?
I've designed a number of systems. The one that you're talking about for yourself is the simplest stepped system. My other systems are designed on a small cart so that they can easily be rolled between inside and outside and contain three troughs rather than the one that contains just two. And it's been designed in a way that makes it really easy to suspend lights at different heights, because when we're starting seedlings, we want the light to be as close as possible to where the seedlings are. But also to cover the planter with a greenhouse cover, which extends our growing season or gives us the ability to control some of the humidity and to optimize the conditions for growing. Now, I've got those systems in 24-inch wide or 2-foot wide systems. I've also got them in 4-foot wide systems. For the indoor and outdoor systems, those are the dominant options that I have available. There's another whole group of planters that I subsequently developed after seeing that there would be a need for them, and these are movable raised bed planters. And one of the things that I'm learning about people who are interested in growing food in the city is that they'll often lose their space for growing within 3 years, which requires that they move from the backyard that they're in or they move from the empty lot that they're on to someplace else. And I wanted to design a system that could be picked up and put onto a flatbed truck and moved from one place to another without losing the investment in the organic soil and without having to suspend the growing process in some cases. So I have movable raised bed planters in 4 feet and 8 feet lengths. And I also have an interesting one that has a vertical gardening option with 3 8-foot planters, one on top of the other. And those can easily be accessed with a movable ladder. And what I envision is places that are on asphalt or places that are indoors in a warehouse or somewhere like that, where people will be growing food intensively, using lights if necessary, and using vertical space to get the most out of the space that we have.
Those are some amazing ideas, really, to be able to pick up your garden and move it. It is certainly the soil that you would miss the most, but even if you have to move in the middle of the season, somebody sold the house or whatever the story is, you could pick it up with the plants, you're saying, and put it somewhere else and keep on growing.
That's correct. And for somebody who wants to create a garden in a school or in a park, we often find that our initial decision about where to locate things and how to lay out the farm that we have is not ideal, and we may want to tweak it. And what I've done is create the opportunity for people to do things in such a way that allows things to be optimized along throughout the process.
Okay, so before we go on to what's happening with the local food movement in Vancouver, and also I'd like to talk a little bit about my own experience in therapeutic indoor gardening, which is a whole other ball of wax, why don't we at least tell people where to find you and what your website is and give them that information?
Sure. So I'm located in Vancouver, and anybody who's interested in seeing the Home Harvest Farms website should go to www.homeharvestfarms.com. And it's probably best if you repeat that, because most people don't understand my English.
Okay, well, I understood it pretty clearly. It's homeharvestfarms.com, right?
That's
okay,
great.
And we can look you up on Facebook as well?
I'm on Facebook and I'm on Twitter as Home Harvest Farm. So no S in the Twitter address.
Okay, I think we've got that. Move on. This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Philip Beer, and that name is spelled B-E-apostrophe-E-R. We're chatting about growing food indoors under lights and much more. Let's move on, Philip, to talking about your sustainability workshops. What are you doing there?
What I'm hoping to work with people on is the opportunities presented by growing food for reducing our carbon emissions by 70%. And while there are a billion different good reasons for growing food, and these include our health, access to fresh, pesticide-free food, one of the things that's overlooked is the advantages when we do grow things organically and locally of reducing carbon emissions associated with the food. Most of the energy that goes into growing our food is in the pesticides and the herbicides and the chemicals that are needed for growing the food on the farm. And from the moment that we take that out of the process and we grow organically, we've massively reduced the footprint of what it is that we're growing. But we also have large amounts of energy going in and coming out of the process associated with how we distribute the food to some degree and all of the packaging and processing that goes into the food that we have. So the closer that we can bring the food to the people who are going to be eating it, and the less we process that, the less energy needs to go into it. And there's almost nothing else that human beings can shift in our lifestyles without radically going back to simplicity. There's almost nothing more effective than growing our own food. It's something with very little investment in both materials and time that everybody, including a young child, can do to help to combat climate change.
Right. So even if you don't have economic worries, which I do, I think the economy's not going very well. Even if you're suspicious of the current food supply, and I'll bet we both are, we know what's happening to it. Things are being poisoned on the farm, and then they're being shot full of things to make them last longer till they get to where we are. But even getting rid of all those ideas, we still have the climate change responsibility. And as you say, we can make some big changes just by learning to grow our own food or helping other people who are growing our own food.
That's absolutely correct. And in the process of doing so, we get all of the benefits that you've just described by not sourcing our food in ways that are damaging to our health and our well-being. But interesting things start to happen when we are growing our own food, and they start to shift the way that we organize ourselves as a society. So one of the things that is difficult for people in North America to do is to share. But the moment we are growing food, we find that we tend to have either a surplus that we want to share with someone. We have to give stuff away or throw it away. And because we grew it ourselves, our tendency is not to throw it away. But we also rapidly run into the challenge of not having enough knowledge because some new pest or some new challenge occurs. And then we become dependent on people to help us resolve these challenges. And very quickly, we find that we're becoming more and more a part of a community of people who are doing similar things. And without knowing it, by exchanging knowledge, by exchanging things that we've grown, we also begin to construct an economy that's a local economy and that is much more robust, potentially, than the economy that is the dominant economy that we're living in.
I'm wondering, too, what have you found that is most interesting to you about the local food movement in Vancouver? I mean, it's pretty active here. A lot of things, the 100-mile diet, very many things have started in Vancouver. I found it a real hotbed of ideas, but what's attracted your interest here?
I'm excited by the level of innovation and motivation. And one of the most exciting projects, because of its large scale, because of its boldness, is a project called Soul Food Farms. They were innovative in the way that they were able to get access to undeveloped land where the person contributing the land got tax benefits from the city by lending their land to Soul Food. Soul Food has demonstrated the scalability of urban farming by putting into place a container garden with somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 12-inch deep containers above asphalt. And they're farming it with people who would not otherwise be able to get regular work. So what they're doing is bringing together people who are looking for employment with available employment, and they're prototyping ways that we can grow our food much more intensively on what people might call brownfield. Soul Food is showing us what can be done on brownfield sites, and they're doing it on a very large scale.
Right. I saw pictures from last year, I think it was, outside the stadium where they play football, and they'd been given a large area of a parking lot, and bang, there it was, an urban farm, and they had all kinds of people employed and all kinds of produce coming out of it.
So their site, they're using between 2 and 3 acres of that site, and there's a lot more land available there, and I'm not sure what the details of that's limiting their use of the entire space. But one of the other beautiful things that we get to see is a demonstration of growing things without mechanization. So the amount of fuel that they're using to run their operation approaches zero. One of the beautiful things that I love about it is their ability to distribute the food to farmers markets and to restaurants using a couple of small vehicles rather than having to truck it across the nation. I don't think they use very much refrigeration at all. They're associated with people who are doing deliveries of food within the city by bicycle.
Well, the good news is, Philip Baer, that this is happening in many cities in the world now. I just spoke with Rashid Nouri this week about a big operation that's happening of urban farming in Atlanta, Georgia. We've heard from Victory Garden movement that's happening in Chicago that's been very successful. Detroit has gotten people out there where houses have been torn down. They've got tractors running. They're starting to grow. So I think this is a movement whose time has come. We're going to stop buying beans that were shipped in from Chile by air and getting things that were really grown locally. So a lot of good things to talk about there. I did want to share with listeners some of my own history about growing things indoors. I'd have to reveal a little bit about myself. I had a couple of serious spinal operations on my neck. I ended up in bed. I couldn't move very much. And I'm kind of a beach guy. I had been sort of almost a surfer at one point, so sunlight was very important to me. We had to move to a bad part of town because I was out of work, and what do you know, we ran into somebody who had to sell their grow-op equipment right quick. I guess he was on his way out of town for some reason. So I got to buy in with a couple of other people, several grow lights for a couple hundred bucks, and did so. Well, I mounted a 600-watt bulb on a kind of a swing-out piece of wood over my bed and painted the whole room yellow. And in fact, the room we're in now is painted yellow as well. But it really helped. You know, I mean, this thing was so bright, you pretty well had to wear sunglasses. You had to have a ballast on the bottom to run it, and you had to make sure your wiring was really good. In fact, I had an electrician come in and run a separate wire from our fuse box to where I was going to run these lights, because this is what happens to grow-ups all over Vancouver, is they catch fire because they don't do their wiring right and pay attention to the load that these things are going to draw. And what happens with the big bulbs, I also got 2,000-watt bulbs, is they use most of their power when they're starting up to get the ballast going, just as fluorescents do. But then they actually use less than, if you have a 1,000-watt bulb, it's not drawing 1,000 watts after the ballast has been heated up and gets going. So you plug it in, you turn it on, you wait for 2 or 3 minutes before you actually get the light that you're going to get out of it. It just slowly builds up and builds up. Anyway, I found it very therapeutic to have this light on. I would have it on almost every rainy gray day and get some sunshine back in my life. It helped me a little bit. It also dried out the room quite a bit, which was important to me because I had arthritis. So, you know, it warmed things up, heated them up, made me feel better. Well, when I was able to get up and around, we had a basement room that wasn't being used. I had been, as I said, a part-time farmer. I was anxious to just do something and grow something. I didn't want to grow pot because I don't like jails and I don't want to go to jail, so I didn't do that. What I did do, though, was set up a couple of fluorescent lights at the time to get my seedlings going for the various things I wanted to grow. I wanted to grow tomatoes, I wanted to grow lettuce, that sort of thing. I tried some squash, that didn't work out as well, but that's another story. And I set up a 600-watt bulb and the 1,000-watt bulb going over some tables, and I had it set up in such a way, as you say, you need to have the plant leaves near the light for it to really work. So when things were small, they'd be up on these tables near the light, but then I could drop them down a little bit. And then I also had the lights on chains suspended from the ceiling so that I could just move up the chain links to move the lights up when I needed to. And I had them kind of double suspended, just using clothesline, two hooks. But I had a second sort of safety line in there in case the first one went, because you don't want those lights to crash. That's another fire hazard. So you put a safety in so that that isn't going to happen to you. Things grew amazingly well, and to go into that room was just as much fun as you can imagine. You had to put your sunglasses on. I used UV-coated sunglasses just to protect my eyes. But I put on a little ocean music while I was doing my gardening. I could hear the waves crashing in the background, and it was just brightened every minute of my day. I still smile thinking about going in there and doing that gardening and having that fun. So I'm just offering that out to listeners to say that in addition to being able to pick your own ripe tomatoes in the darkest December and getting your own fresh lettuce, and you can't beat that, there's a goodness for your heart possible in this, so long as you're not powering those lights burning coal or nuclear fuel. So keep that in mind. Where's your power coming from? But if it's from a decent source, or if you can set up your own solar panels, even better. So there's another way to grow things too, I'm saying, and that is to use big grow lights and have a lot of fun. And so what's your take on that?
I loved listening to you telling your story. One of the things that we haven't spoken about is what's happening with the global food system, because I am concerned with all of the droughts and the flooding and the things that seem to be bringing the system to a place where it's not dependable anymore, is increasing horticultural literacy among both children and adults as rapidly as possible, and supporting the rapid diffusion of knowledge so that we can know as a society how to take care of ourselves. And one of the challenges that I think that we're going to be facing is the need to rapidly expand locally grown food, but we're not going to have seeds available for doing that when people en masse approach West Coast Seeds and places like that to say, guys, I need to be growing something for my family to eat. Or when we start looking for nutrient materials so that we can grow food in soil, but the natural occurring soil is contaminated or is not suitable for growing things. I encourage people to do the kind of experimentation and to grow the kind of garden that you were describing in whatever space they have, whether it's inside or outside, so that we develop the demand and we develop the tools as rapidly as possible to weather whatever kind of climate storms are coming our way.
You raise a really, really good point. I mean, we're thinking about the drought that's happening in the Midwest, and that's still continuing into this winter, incidentally, of the United States. Britain is sort of flooded out. I don't know how their farm crop is going to come this year. It all depends on whether it dries out enough in the spring, whether they can get into the fields. Australia, as we know, had just record burning heat and forest fires to go with it. And we're just at the start of this. We're at the very start of climate change. We've hardly had anything yet, not to mention the storms and the hailstorms and the tornadoes and all of that. So the kind of product that you're selling, and we're talking with Philip Baer of homeharvestfarms.com, you said to me, well, okay, nobody's going to feed themselves from this little system, but they are going to learn how, and the knowledge is going to spread, and if I learn how, it might spread through my family. And so it's a start.
That's correct. And with the larger systems that I've developed, what I'm looking at is being able to deploy food growing containers above asphalt, above contaminated ground, and basically above cityscapes. And this may include rooftops. It may be the parking lots above malls, and it might just be above the ground. But the beauty of the style of system that I've been working on is that it uses a very small amount of nutrient and a very small amount of soil and water to create growing environments very, very rapidly. So if I were to receive an order from a city like the city of Vancouver for 10,000 of these units, we would be able to put these on the boulevards and on the unused streets of the city. And with enough educated people, enough soil and enough seeds, we could be growing huge amounts of food in the city within a very short period of time.
And you mentioned, though, one of the weak spots could be the seeds. What are we going to do about that?
That is something that by having this conversation, hopefully people will be listening to what we're talking about and seeing the opportunities for doing something with that. But if nobody comes up with some way of dealing with that aspect of the climate crisis and the peak oil crisis and the population crisis that are all converging right now, it's an end game for human beings, potentially.
Well, we're going to have to be more than growers. We're going to have to be seed savers as well, and there's techniques to be learned, but it's not that hard. People have been doing it for thousands of years, so I guess we have to take on that mantle as well.
That is probably one of the most important roles for people in our society today who want to make a valuable contribution.
Okay. Well, we're starting to run out of time, Philip. I'm wondering if there's other things that you'd like to talk with us about.
The one thing that's on my mind is a concern about the agricultural lands proximate to Vancouver that are being threatened by rising sea levels, where already we're starting to see water infiltrating, saltwater infiltrating, and destroying our ability to grow food in these places. These are Richmond and Delta and parts of the Fraser Valley. And before we lose that rich agricultural land, I would love to see these cities adopting forms of agriculture that raise the agriculture above the ground using systems like the style of system that I've designed, because I believe that we're going to need to be eating food from as close by as possible, and it would be a terrible shame to lose both these places and the fertile soil that's there today.
You know, I've looked into that, and this is a problem in many places where we broadcast. San Francisco is one for sure, because salinity could work its way all the way up to Sacramento through the water system they've got there. It's a big problem. Rising seas is a threat, and of course the storm surges that drive them. We've got the same thing going on in Chesapeake Bay. That's a big agricultural area, and a lot of good growing land could be lost. And when we look around the world, we find out that the best growing lands are in river deltas right by the sea. That's where a large part of the world population is currently located. So we've got to stop climate change before it wipes out our agricultural capabilities, or millions will starve. And it's possible millions will starve anyway, but we hope not, and we're going to try and prevent this from happening. And as you've told us today, growing your own food is something that each of us can do to lower the climate threat. So I want to thank you very much for coming by and stopping in and talking with us today. Our guest has been Philip Baer. He's with homeharvestfarms.com here in Vancouver. You can find that on the internet and look at the products that some of which, did you invent some of those products?
All of those have been designed by me. All of the soil-based products have been designed by me.
Right. Okay. So he's worked it up himself, and I think we've got some original material here that some of you will be interested in. Thank you so much for listening. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. In a little bit, we are going to talk with Walter Haugen, an outdoor grower in Washington State. But first, I'd like to share a few more notes about growing indoors under lights. In my mind, there's a hierarchy of home agriculture. First and foremost, we do almost all of our gardening under the sun as nature intended it. That's where most of your growing should happen, whether it's on your city lot or pots in the patio or wherever you've got. Maybe a community garden. Second, we grab the harvest when it's there. Get the book, Putting Food By, to find out how in detail for every kind of food. Freezing has its place, especially for the berries, but I still prefer drying food and canning the rest. That way we don't depend on the grid or use still more fossil fuels just to keep our food over the winter. Anybody with a yard can build a root cellar or use a basement to store a harvest plenty, and when prices are cheap and the local food abounds, that's the time to get it. Only after that, or in unusual circumstances, would I supplement the real solar harvest with food and herbs grown indoor under lights. It's super legitimate to get seeds and seedlings started under a few fluorescent bulbs in the spring. Speaking of that, I dragged out my old 24-inch two-bulb fluorescent grow lamp from 15 years ago to compare it to the new model Philip Baer brought me. There has been a ton of progress in fluorescent grow lamps, mainly due to stimulation from the multi-billion dollar pot-growing industry. My old fluorescent lamp is big, it has a ballast noisy with a hum you can hear, and the main difference is in its pure sunlight brightness. The old fluorescents, with 8 watts per bulb, look pale and pasty compared to the T5 Sunblaster I got from Philip. That's a single bulb, 24 watts in a 24-inch model. It doesn't hum. It's slim and it's lightweight. It appears to come from a company called Future Harvest Development, and that has a website called extremegrowing.com. Adding the optional Nanotech T5 reflector forces all the light downward toward the plant where it should be. Just eyeballing it, this new unit is far brighter in the spectrums that count than the old fluorescent grow bulbs you may have seen a few years ago. And the new ones run cool. That means you can get them closer to the leaves where the light needs to be. One 24-inch light with an on-off switch sells for $32 in Canada. The reflector is another $20. You could make your own out of aluminum foil, but I like the reflector that fits the unit well. My only beef with the low-end unit I got from Philip at Home Harvest Farms is the wire supports meant to hold that light up. It isn't reliable. It's just poked into the soil, and when that soil shifts, as it will when you water it, the light can fall down. I built a light stand using a 2x2 and a 1x1, both 8 feet long, plus 8 screws and one metal L-bracket. The whole thing costs less than $8. You can find a photo of that little light stand at my blog at ecoshock.info. That way I can use cheap chain to raise and lower the lights as the plants start out or as they grow. Future Harvest also sells a light stand for the T5. It does look better, but I don't think it would extend high enough for the deep trays that Philip provided. My first intention was simply to have some fresh herbs for the kitchen when cooking. In that scenario, you hope the herbs will grow enough that you can pick them without killing the plant. You're not trying to get them to flower, and you don't want them to go to seed. What if I did want to grow some lettuce and then save the seed, or even a small bush mini tomato plant? When the plants were mature enough, I would have to change the light bulb in the fluorescent. Most plants depend on subtle light signals to fruit or bloom, the kind of redness in the sky that happens later in the season. The normal vegetative bulb in my unit is rated at 6400K. That K stands for Kelvin. It's a standard way of measuring the light waves known as color temperature. Look it up in Wiki. To stimulate fruit and bloom, I would change to a color temperature of 2700K. That's a more ready orange shade. You would have to order that from a local dealer. As soon as I set up my unit, I noticed other changes. When you transplant basil, for example, its aroma fills the room for several days until it settles down. I hope you like basil. Next, the cat showed up. She did not nibble any leaves. These were not on her menu. But Kitty likes to lay down in front of the planter, under the fake sunlight, on a dreary day. Sooner or later, some unwelcome insects will also find my kitchen garden. They always do. I'll have to have some non-toxic insecticidal soap on the ready for the aphids. Of course, having some extra sunlight in the room adds some cheer. I've noticed it. I've got the lights on a timer, running 16 hours with 8 hours of darkness. That has worked well for me in the past, but if you have better info, let me know. So I'm looking at vegetative plants like herbs and salad fixings. I bought some small herbs in tiny pots already growing to stock up. 2 of cilantro, we like pesto here, a basil plant, 2 oregano, and 1 thyme plant. The rest of the planter will go to heirloom lettuce, likely either very dark or colored leaves. But what if I want more, like the holy grail of indoor gardeners, the tomato? Frankly, those plants are overrated for the watts they consume. Why not plant things like beets where you can eat the roots and the tops instead of throwing out most of the plant? If you want tomatoes, you need more serious lights, in my opinion. A 600-watt bulb would do one plant. A 1,000-watt bulb would grow several large tomato plants. You can buy those. Again, you would have to buy maybe a 1,000-watt fruiting bulb at 2,700K to make the tomatoes happen. The electricity expense will never justify the cost of those tomatoes. But You can get fresh heirloom tomatoes when they are ripe in December anytime, and you know that they don't have pesticides all over them. Perhaps if we subtract all the fossil-based fertilizers and insecticides that you didn't use, the tractor fuel and the trucking emissions to bring them north, the cost of carbon might even out. If you know anyone who has done these calculations, please write me. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. As I said, I wouldn't take on the big lights at all if your electricity comes from coal or nuclear fuel. Could you grow with solar power? Well, certainly you could, using these modern high-powered fluorescents. The 4-foot-long bulbs put out 54 watts of power. That's twice as bright without using very much juice. You might still need either wind power or the grid to back you up after a week of cloudy, rainy weather. Growing plants indoors requires dependable light every day. Otherwise, the plants can stall, and you lose more than just a day or two of growth. Commercial greenhouses use the lights every day without fail. It mainly depends on where you live, doesn't it? If you're in a sunny region, I'll bet you could be growing even during the cold times using a combination of a skylight or greenhouse supplemented with fluorescent grow lights. Please let me know your experiences. Before we get to our next guest, Philip Baer brought up one scary point. The real bottleneck to the new local food movement might be seeds. What if we are too successful? Could the non-GMO seed houses keep up? What if a stock market crash convinces millions of ordinary people to tear up their lawns and plant? Will there be enough seeds? I posed this question to Chris at the Incredible Seed Company, a Canadian outfit that provides heirloom seeds. Chris doesn't sell so-called survival packs, even though he could make some extra money at it. Instead, he recommends you start planting anything, anywhere, and buy a book on how to save seeds. You can't save the seeds from things you grow from Home Depot seeds or Walmart. Unless it says heirloom and non-GMO right on the package, they will be hybrid seeds, and they won't grow true to the form you expect the next year. Your seed saving will be wasted. Anyway, Chris thinks that if there was a sudden move towards local home farming, that there would be enough seeds because the big companies would just divert seeds from farmers, where they don't make a lot of money when they sell them in bulk, to the local market where they can make more money. So probably we would have the seeds, but they'd be GMO seeds. They would be hybrids, so that's not so good. I need to do a whole program on seeds, the survival packs, saving your own, and the various societies like Seed Saviors and the Seedy Saturday events put out by an outfit called Seeds of Diversity. You can help. Please send me your experiences, your recommendations for products or companies that work for you, or guests I should interview about seeds for Radio EcoShock. Send all those tips to my email box. It's radio@ecoshock.org. With your help, we can do a good program on seeds.
Number down low, so we don't have to go. 350. Let me hear you if you're with me. Ain't it sweet? Get down with 350.
Well, it's time for us humans to open our eyes, and it should come as no surprise that the natural world has been compromised by the Industrial Revolution. Instead of sustainable solutions, we've been burning coal and sucking up oil, polluting the air and the water, the soil. The amount of carbon in the atmosphere has gone beyond what we can endure. 350 parts per million, that's the number we need. And right now we're pushing 390.
That's a bit from May Earlwine at the 350 Get Down.
Get down with 350.
It's fun and helpful to talk with small alternative growers around the country and around the world. Right now we'll go to Walter Hagen, and then I've got a new song for you from the Australian group Pagan Love Cult. I think you'll appreciate both their sound and their message.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
Please don't forget to support Radio EcoShock. Help pay those bills. You can donate at our website at ecoshock.org or at our show blog at ecoshock.info. We're going to pay a short visit to a man I'll call the Spreadsheet Farmer. His new book is The Laws of Physics Are on My Side, but he's not a physicist. He has training in anthropology instead. Walter Haugen is an educated wanderer. He's a former field worker, and he's turned into a food grower. Walter, why don't you tell us, where are you located and how much land do you have in production?
Okay, how you doing, Alex? I am located just outside of Ferndale, Washington. It's in the northwest corner of Washington State, so sometimes we call it the fourth corner. And we've got a little farm here. It's a diversified farm. I grow about 60 to 80 different crops, and it's on 5 acres, but I only intensively cultivate 1 to 2 acres, depending on the years. And so, for instance, this last year in 2012 was 1 acre, and then 1.5 that was actually tilled.
And you're doing it as community-supported agriculture as well? Like you're actually selling food out to other people from that amount of land?
Yes, I am. I sell a few CSA shares every year. Last year, I tried something new. I did a gift economy idea where I gave away free CSA shares to poor people. And then asked for donations. Didn't get any, of course. But I did get one person who was willing to come out and put some time in. And then I also, I take in volunteers, and they come out and work, and I pay them in food.
Why are you aiming to go beyond organic?
Well, the thing is that both in keeping the soil clean, being a good soil steward, but also just the energy level requires us to go organic. I think Richard Heidenberg years ago said, don't even worry about organic, because in 50 years, everybody would be organic anyway. I grew up on a farm, and the inputs increased dramatically. The chemical fertilizer inputs increased dramatically after the war, and even more so in the 70s. And it's just, it takes so much energy, and the reason we are eating petroleum is because of not only the large amount of fuel in tractors, but also just the large amount of fuel that it takes to make the chemical fertilizers. And we don't need to do that. We can actually quantify sustainability. And when we do that, we see that the organic method is better.
Do you have a tractor? And if not, what machines are you using?
I don't have a tractor, and I have a DCS tiller. It's a walk-behind tiller, and it has a standard transmission, three speeds forward, two back. And it allows me to do an awful lot of work for very low inputs. So, for instance, I can grow 10,000 pounds of food on about 10 to 12 gallons of fuel every year, plus my own labor.
And you use your body as one of the tools of farming.
That's correct. I'm a biological anthropologist, and it's real clear to me that the most efficient engine we have is the human body. We can get an awful lot done on very low inputs. I work long days in the summer, but I don't put out an awful lot of energy. And so my metric is 125 kilocalories per hour, and you can produce an awful lot of food with that.
Well, Walter Haugen, what are your thoughts on the relationships between climate change and food production?
Well, unfortunately, climate change is in a positive feedback loop now, for instance, because of the adiabatic effect in the Arctic and others. And so we really have to deal with new crops, new varieties in the crops, new ways to grow food. For example, I have 30 different varieties of potatoes, but I'm also I developed two new varieties myself using the seed ball technique that Luther Burbank used, and I'm developing, new varieties of corn that are intrinsic to the Pacific Northwest here, because we're going to need to adapt, these different crops and varieties to climate change. And climate change is not just more carbon dioxide or an overall increase. In this area, for instance, it means longer, cooler springs, and so you have a germination problem. So you have to have seeds that will come up quick, things like that.
Well, I want to tip off listeners to a paper I found in your blog, and it was published in February 2013 by Tufts University, titled Climate Impacts on Agriculture, A Challenge to Complacency. It's by Frank Ackerman and Elizabeth A. Stanton. I'll put a link to that paper in my show blog at ecoshock.info, and we're going to give out your blog information pretty shortly. Well, I want to ask you what varieties of food you grow, but I realize that might take half an hour just to answer that one question. So instead, can you explain why you use a spreadsheet to keep track of what you produce?
Well, you know, I used to be an archaeologist, and I understand how data collection in the field can sort of tweak, or it impacts your methodology, it impacts your theory, it impacts your analysis. So you've got to be rigorous, and one of the ways to be rigorous is you start with a coherent vision of what you're doing. So, for instance, I have every variety and every succession planting I do has its own line in the spreadsheet, and this has the square footage. It has the, you know, variety, the days that it should be ready, you know, et cetera, and comments. And then in my harvest spreadsheet, I have, you know, how many pounds I get per acre of that. And everything is weighed as it comes in from the field and in the shop. Everything's weighed, and I'm real rigorous about that because that's necessary. But once I have all this data, I can tell you certain things. For example, I can tell you that I'm, in 2012, I was had a 25% increase in my efficiency. I had basically the same amount of food produced as 2011, but with only $1,500 instead of $2,000. So having all that data in a coherent fashion, in an orderly fashion, shall we say, helps you think in orderly way.
It is March in Washington State. What are you doing to prepare for the coming season?
Okay, right now I already have onions up in my seed plants and transplants. And I'm doing cabbages and other brassicas today, you know, broccoli and cauliflower. Soon, I'll, you know, towards the end of March, I'll be doing, you know, tomatoes. And then in April, I'll be doing peppers and things like that. I can't get out into the field now because it's far too wet. You don't want to compact your soil and turn it into muck. So right now is my off season. So, for instance, this time last year, I was writing my book.
Let's talk about that book. Why did you call it The Laws of Physics Are on My Side?
You know, since I'm an anthropologist and a farmer, you know, it appeared to me that the peak oil and the climate change people weren't looking at the intersection of culture and energy. And we've been cultural animals for 2 million years, and it's only in the last 150 million years that we've been able to replace cultural behaviors with just cheap oil energy. And now we just throw more oil energy at any and all problems, and we're losing our ability to adjust. It's as if cheap oil energy has replaced culture. And this is a problem because we're in peak oil now. We're using far too much energy, and it's changing the climate. And these are interactive variables. And so we need to do something different. And part of the book is, about a third of the book is analysis and two-thirds is solutions. And so I wanted to look at it from a historical perspective and also just, you know, put a different spin on it. You know, people buy the modern narrative, you know, and they don't really look at what is actually happening. So, for instance, you know, we have, each of us in the U.S., we have 91 energy slaves at our disposal because of the amount of oil and coal energy we use. And we could get by on much, much less, and we're going to have to in the future, I think.
Well, I appreciated in the back of the book some of your tips from experience about everything from fruit trees to the various vegetable crops that we might grow. Is the book available in electronic form? Where else can we get it? Do you have a website or a blog?
The book is on Amazon, both in a paperback and a Kindle version. And you can buy the Kindle version and download it. There are free apps, so you can download it to your computer and read it if you like. Or you can download it and get a free app for your iPad or your Android. So it's available for people, you know, instantly to read it, like, you know, while they're riding the subway, for instance. My website is www.fafarm.org, and that's mostly a static website. I don't blog much on there anymore because I've got other work to do. If you go to the Transition Whatcom site, which is transitionwhatcom.ning.com, you know, I have lots of blogs on there because, you know, since that's a local site and I'm involved locally, it's to my advantage to try and get my word out locally, see.
So you're involved in the transition movement?
Yes, I have been from the start here in Whatcom County. It's interesting because a lot of the stuff in the transition movement is just a recast of what we were doing in the early 70s. But, you know, hopefully they've got better marketing and they can sort of pull in more people from the perimeters, you know. Back in the 70s, we just you know, it was difficult to get people on board, and hopefully the transition movement is addressing that. You know, there are pluses and minuses, as with any movement.
You know, I'd like to talk to you longer. We're sort of running out of time here. As we finish up, is there an idea or message that you'd like to add?
Well, the main thing is, as I close my book, you don't change your paradigm in your head. You change your paradigm by getting your hands in the soil. And that's what I think people need to do. Everybody needs to grow some of their own food. You can start with 5%. You can grow a 30 by 30 garden, or you can do some container gardening. But once you get your hands in the soil and actually observe how nature works, that will help change your paradigm and will, in, you know, be better for your survival.
So you can grow by growing. Well, Walter, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, you bet. Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thanks to a listener from Australia, I've covered Pagan Love Cult. It's the only cult in the world that tries to brainwash its members to think for themselves. PaganLoveCult.com. Visit that website, and for a limited time only, you can hear their inspiring song, You Are Here. We opened the program with a quick clip from their ode to beatnik Neil Cassidy. Now here's a full tune with the corporate angst and common folk rising. It's called Everything I Know.
Transition, the end of the line. They were sending in the troopers to defend a private mine. One person in 100 was gonna turn a nice buck, but the rest of the community was out of luck. We thought we lived in paradise, our feet upon the ground. What lies below the surface, though, belongs to the crown. And the government looks after it on behalf of this great nation. They've just gone and sold it to a multinational corporation. And everything I know is telling me that this is the wrong way to go. Every single place I've been, it's always more concrete, encroaching on the green, riding on your economic wave. Why you eat your own children and dig your own grave? But this is where we make our stand. You might own the courtrooms, but the people own the land. Take a nice piece of bushland, dig a bloody big hole, fill it full of poison, sit back and count your gold. Move on to the next place when this one runs dry, but the water's all connected and there's only one sky. They're coming right at us, anyone can see. No one's gonna save us now, it's down to you and me. Come and help your neighbors stop the bastards getting through. Come and meet the mining company before they come for you. And everything I know is telling me that this is the wrong way to go. Every single place I've been, it's always more concrete, encroaching on the green, riding on your economic wave. When it crashes to the shore, there won't be nothing left to say. But this is where we make our stand. You might own the courtrooms, but the people own the land. It was a time of redemption, a season most strange. Rednecks and hippies agreeing for a change. But it's not just us extremists with our shotguns and fleas. This is such insanity that everyone